Hi, it's Kate Brownfield from ADHDKidsCanThrive.com. Thank you for being here and thank you for listening. I appreciate all your support. My guest today is Dr. Mark Burton, a board-certified developmental behavioral pediatrician. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at New York Medical College. He leads mindfulness classes and is the author of several books. Some are titled The Family ADHD Solution, Mindful Parenting for ADHD, Mindfulness and Self-Compassion for Teen ADHD, and How Children Thrive. I invited Dr. Burton to join me today on the podcast to discuss how parents raising kids who struggle with ADHD, and perhaps their kids too, how they can benefit from a mindfulness and self-compassion practice. Please enjoy our conversation. Thank you, Dr. Burton, for joining me today. I am really looking forward to speaking to you. Today, we're going to dive into a topic that isn't always talked about, but I think is probably one of the most important aspects of parenting a child with ADHD, is how to kind of master, include mindfulness and self-compassion into your life when you're a parent, and then how to also work on instilling that into your child as well.
Yeah, obviously one of my favorite topics. If we're going to talk about it, I think you kind of have to normalize it from the start, because I think mindfulness gets talked about so many different ways. So I think really just from the beginning, even the word can be like a trigger for some people. So really, the practice of mindfulness is meant to be totally accessible, totally practical, not like a miracle cure for everything, but a support for kind of lots and lots of things, almost everything. Because mindfulness doesn't mean still mind, and it doesn't mean we're going to be calm all the time. And a lot of the cliches people are worried about, really what the practice of mindfulness implies is that we're choosing to put the effort into building certain habits that just make managing life more straightforward. And I think it's something most people intuitively understand when you see it that way. You know, we've mostly, handle challenges more easily when we've had a moment, maybe take a vacation or relax or to take care of ourselves. And if we stay caught up in exhaustion and reactivity and all the rest that life drives us towards, you know, it's harder to manage life. So mindfulness, I can define it more specifically in a second, but I want to pause. But mindfulness in general is a way of really choosing to cultivate more productive habits and staying, instead of staying all caught up in the kind of the reactivity we're driven to just by daily life quite often.
Yeah. And that's the balance. Easier said than done, right?
Of course. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Longstanding thing you talk about mindfulness is it's really way simpler to describe than it is to practice. But it's kind of like a gym program. Anything you practice regularly becomes more habitual. So
exactly.
Including mindfulness, including self-compassion. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what is it about? Let's just start with like ADHD, because that's what we're going to talk about today. Right. What is it about ADHD that makes life for parents especially more stressful and chaotic?
Well, I want to answer that, but let's also just table for a second, but, haven't really defined mindfulness, so I'll come back to that too in a moment. But I think to start with ADHD first, our current understanding of ADHD, I think the most practical way for any parent to even really understand all the details of managing it is that it is, practically speaking, a developmental delay of a very wide-ranging skill set called executive function, which is like your life management skills. So that includes attention, that includes behavior, but also organization, planning, time management, emotion, effort. It's almost like anything you can put the word manage to relates to ADHD. You have to manage attention, you have to manage emotions, you have to manage projects, you have to manage conversations and relationships. And therefore, all of that can be affected by ADHD and poor executive function, which in a broad way has multiple implications for parents. I mean, first of all, on just a bare bones level, it's always obviously stressful for us when our children struggle in general. But then when kids have ADHD, they really are delayed in the skills that allow them to be independent. They're delayed in skills that allow them to manage their emotions. And ADHD is a planning disorder, so that really the intervention itself is what gets you to the point where one day you can manage your own ADHD. But as long as you have ADHD, you're kind of in this unique loop of the plans you make to manage your ADHD are undermined by having ADHD. So kids rely on adult created supports, you know, hugely at the beginning. It always like falls heavily on parents, and there's a lot of research backing that up.
Yeah.
And then that creates a situation where managing ADHD is hard to do. So if you're wiped out by ADHD, it gets, you know, it's harder to do the things people are asking you to do to manage ADHD, which is why I, you know, decided years ago to try to start integrating mindfulness into care, because if we can stay resilient as parents, you know, that allows us to do all the rest more easily.
I think social media, podcasts, these things are helping make it more people more aware, I think, that what's going on individually in their life, right, isn't isolated to just them. This is the condition of raising an ADHD child, right? And so now if you can harness that mindfulness around that, it can really be beneficial. So let's talk about the benefits of being mindful as a parent, even if your child isn't ready to be mindful. The power of a parent being mindful.
Yeah, the kids come second, almost for sure. And again, so, you know, mindfulness can be looked at least a couple of different ways. And one of my favorite, like, thumbnail instructions around even practicing is there's a centuries-old instruction of when you hear stuff about mindfulness, ask yourself, is it true? So as I even start describing this, like, be a skeptic and just, like, explore whether you think this would be helpful. So the exact definition of mindfulness is aiming to be more aware of moment to moment life with a sense of unbiased objectivity. You know, moment giving, there's different word, you know, language that's used, but basically we're trying to see life as it's really happening with less reactivity. You know, and you know, you can just start from a teenager said this the other day of like, well, you know, when would it not be better to be aware? But that takes effort. You know, we live our lives sort of caught up in the state of autopilot, and we're just kind of, you know, doing things without giving them our attention, and doing things if we're not giving them our attention, therefore out of habit. So the practice of mindfulness isn't one that ever reaches some endpoint of perfection. You know, the assumption really is that if we don't keep putting effort into it, we're going to fall back into our old habits. So it's more like a gym program. But the initial value is like, recognizing that if we, through the practice of mindfulness, which is often meditation-based, but not fully meditation-based, we build these traits like catching ourselves when we're distracted and coming back more often, and developing a sense of patience and the ability to experience something challenging without immediately falling into reactivity. And then a really big part of mindfulness practice is just developing a sense of resilience. And there's many different reasons why that's true. Some of it is that one way to reframe meditation so it's even more accessible to people is that we're not trying to focus our attention perfectly. What we're trying to do is build resilience. You're sort of giving yourself permission for 15 minutes or whatever you pick to experience whatever's happening without having to fix it, unless, you know, it's, and even then, unless something urgent comes up, in which case you fix it. You know, it's not meant to be passive. But just to end tying this back to something that's very common in ADHD care, the concept of giving full attention to our lives moment to moment directly builds resilience because of that same sense of autopilot. Because what tends to happen is that we have all these cognitive filters we're seeing life through. One of the most powerful ones is called the negativity bias, which is like an evolutionary tendency to pay most attention to the things that need fixing and changing or seem off. So we need that. But if we don't actively try to balance it, what happens? It means that for ourselves throughout the day, when positive things go on, we're quite often just caught up in, like, you know, the negative. We're thinking about something else. We're caught up in all the stuff that's scaring us, which means we don't really experience them. So it's not meant to falsely pretend positive things are going on. It's just that when something that might help us feel better is going on happens, we're more likely to catch ourselves and pay attention to it, but to sort of immerse ourselves in those few minutes of like, it's been a really lame day, but right now I'm having coffee with a friend and I'm just going to, you know, experience that. So I enjoy it. Or I'm going to take a walk and I'm just going to focus on that. And when I get caught up in the, you know, the stories of the future, I'm just going to come back to just walking. And if you make that a practice, it helps you build resilience as an adult individually. But that naturally blends into, you know, a lot of parenting interventions. Most parenting interventions, for example, talk about starting with the, you know, presence and giving full attention to our children when we're together, which in the modern world isn't so easy. And then also giving what's often called targeted praise to our children, recognizing that kids with ADHD by necessity are corrected an awful lot because they're off task in different ways. And then when you start almost any parenting program I'm aware of, part one of just sort of building relationship and steering kids towards the right behavior is starting to give attention to those positive behaviors. And when you think about the average morning where you're trying to rush out the door with a child with ADHD, it's total chaos and you're trying to do three things and they're supposed to be doing things and their siblings are trying to do things. And probably the first attention, if you don't put some effort into it, they're going to get from you is when you're running a little late and you say, wait, you haven't packed your backpack yet? And that's the first thing they hear. But if you are trying to give awareness, if you're just practicing targeted praise, which is a behavioral intervention, and mindfulness, which is about being aware, you might recognize they said something nice to their sister for once, and they brushed their teeth, and they got on their shoes, which are both successful activities. And maybe you give them a little positive feedback for those activities. And this is another way you cumulatively build a child's self-esteem and resilience, and can totally be supported by mindfulness, which is just giving awareness to life and trying to see the full picture of everything that's going on.
Yeah, the picture. Yep. And I think through mindfulness too, then in practice over time, you learn that if they didn't pack their backpack, that's not something to react to, or it doesn't become the thing.
There's multiple habits you can choose to work on through mindfulness. It evolves over time and you can work on different things. And absolutely, that's one of the things you're directly practicing is, stuff is going to happen in life. And what we most directly influence is how we react to it or don't, and so that can mean a lot of different things. And one of them could just be recognizing, for example, to tie a couple of things we talked about together, anyways, when I feel like I'm getting a little in the weeds and I want to make it practical, if you look at this on a practical level, one of the most important things in terms of the unbiased, mindful objective view of ADHD is just recognizing that it's an actual skill set that's behind, so that kids are not choosing to forget to pack their backpack.
Right.
They're having a hard time with the morning routine because of poor executive function. So over the long haul, we have to intervene and try to, teach them the right skills. But just like you're saying, in the short run, if we're practicing responsiveness, it's often called, the ability to experience something without immediately reacting and getting caught up in it, we might be able to better catch ourselves and realize okay, we need the backpack packed and it's not, and that doesn't need a correction, but I can choose to do it in a less reactive, more positive way, because I recognize that this is part of ADHD and it's frustrating, and I can experience the emotions of this is frustrating and I'm afraid I'm going to be late for work, and all of that's real. But because we practice this trait of patience, we can sort of build our ability to catch ourselves before we fall down, the next rabbit hole of, I get reactive and then they get reactive and then the whole morning unravels, Right. So it doesn't mean you're okay in the purest sense with the backpack not being packed, because that's frustrating, but you might handle it really differently because you've been practicing. And it's one of the most direct ties between mindfulness and ADHD in general, really, because obviously a lot of parents of kids with ADHD have their own ADHD. There's been studies of mindfulness, ADHD, and emotion. And one of the most direct things we're practicing when we practice mindfulness is the ability to, recognize our emotional awareness or emotional management, which is obviously something we all would like in life. So as you're practicing mindfulness, you're practicing that ability to, notice your emotion without suppressing it and without getting caught up in it, and then, choose how to act next, as opposed to, what most of us grew up with, which is more a mishmash of emotional awareness and a lot of reactivity around our emotions.
Yeah.
And we kind of have to learn something different,
Yeah, that's the challenge. And then I think, how do you do this when the world is so, feels like it's going a million miles per hour?
Right, right.
I mean, it's just so hectic, the pressures on the parents and the kids. And I do think some of it also is, school is designed 100% on kids cognitively thriving. And that doesn't always play to how kids who are struggling that doesn't always match, which causes tension, and you can just get in this cycle of like the world is against you, I guess. So how do you be mindful in spite of that?
Huh. There's so many different pieces to that. I think
that's the challenge of this journey.
That is, I mean, so yeah, I'm just specific because there are several different things you touched on there. I mean, you know, starting with the practicality of, you know, that's, you know, part of seeing clearly why children, you know, obviously need a very detailed school plan if they're going to start feeling better. So it's like, it's not, again, like mindfulness fixes everything.
Yeah.
I mean, part of what you're suggesting is that's why kids need a really, you know, in, you know, appropriate school plan so they can feel more successful in school. But really, you know, it's hard, like you said before, it's simple to describe and the details are kind of endless. But in the biggest picture, the whole premise and practice of mindfulness comes down to the idea that, you know, life is going to happen and all we really control is how we relate to that. You know, it doesn't mean we have to like everything that's going on, but when positive things are going on, even in the midst of the chaos we're all living through right now, it's just vital to our resilience that we actually register them and focus on them. And among the most, you know, studied interventions that improves happiness and well-being in general in people is something are things like gratitude practice, which, you know, can sound like the cheesiest thing ever, but it's not. It's really just a recognition that we need to cultivate balance because otherwise the negativity bias takes over.
Yeah.
And then another, you know, another part of it is sort of being mindful in the sense of being aware of the lifestyle choices we're taking. And, you know, do we need to be as scheduled as we are? Or do we need to be doom scrolling quite as often as we are, or caught up in social media? Or are we, you know, prioritizing time with the people who make us, you know, feel stronger? Or are we sort of out of, you know, because they're pulling and calling to us, spending a lot of time with people who are wearing us down? And, you know, you can't fully control that, but we can try to, you know, prioritize the people who make us feel better and prioritize, you know, getting off the websites that are making us feel worse. And all these things add up.
Yeah.
And that's part of answering your question, you know, in the big picture. And then when it comes to ADHD, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, there's so much to handle when it comes to managing ADHD, and there's no one intervention that fixes it all at once, but there's a lot of pressure and a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of self-judgment. We haven't even touched on self-compassion yet. And, you know, a lot of fear of some of the treatments. Like, you know, I think one of the things that unnecessarily wears parents down is all the misinformation about the medication.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's just totally unfair to parents that they're demonized when, you know, you have 100 years of research saying they're safe and effective if they're used appropriately. You know, no one should use a medicine they don't need in life. But there's no need to be particularly afraid of ADHD medication. But that's another weight on parents is the
yes.
way they're presented. And all of that adds up. So you just got to, you know, try to, you know, work on the habits literally in terms of, you know, how you're living day to day, and habits, you know, mentally in terms of how you're approaching ADHD, and just try over time to build up the ones that help you stay resilient. Because, you know, like I talked about before, parenting kids with ADHD, I mean, the research shows that it causes marital strife and anxiety and stress about decision making. And so anything you can do to help manage that level of thinking better and to feel more balanced and just stronger and resilient as a whole, you know, then leads into everything else, because, you know, managing a behavioral plan is really hard. So if you feel, you know, more resilient and more clear-sighted, behavioral plans might go easier. You know, dealing with the school can be challenging. Making medical decisions can be challenging. So you want to start from a place of resilience so that everything else falls into place more easily.
So it's time well spent to try to do a practice of being mindful.
Yeah.
And so what are different kinds of practices? So like, I think there's like secular practices, if you're not religious, or even spiritual practices, right?
Well,
can build a mindful practice?
Well, I think that's totally individual. I mean, I think, you know, the way mindfulness in the West is typically talked about is a secular practice, although clearly if it, you know, for anybody individually who ties into the spirituality, it has been, you know, discussed in sort of every, you know, religious belief system that I'm aware of, you know, so it can be part of any broader spiritual practice. But I think for a discussion like today, I think it's really helpful to frame it as, you know, secular cognitive practices that like anybody can do. You can believe whatever you want. You can be a totally distracted, restless person, and it all works. It's all fine. It's all just part of the practice. And there's two or three different things in terms of getting started with practice that are worth focusing on? You know, I think for today, you know, just based on the questions you've asked so far today, you know, on the one hand, there is a little bit of a gym program aspect to it, right? So that some of it is when you meditate in this model, trying to relax. I mean, it is often relaxing. You're trying to build traits over time. So you're sort of setting aside short-term goals. So part of the practice is, even if there's some research that came out in the last couple of years that said as little as 12 minutes a day, you can start to see changes. So, you know, just putting aside 12 minutes a day is something most people can do, and you just practice and you just see what happens over time. You know, the type of practice that we typically start with in mindfulness is often a breathing practice, but it's not magic. It's really just that when you're breathing, which is all the time, there's a physical movement to the body with each breath, and it's something you can focus on that's more neutral and isn't everywhere our mind's caught up in. So it's very just like just using it as an anchor and just practicing that. And lots of other things unfold. And that's one second.
Do you
thing.
Recommend like an app? Or, I mean, if you can
most
do
people
it.
People need some guidance initially. Yeah. And I have the easiest thing for a shorter, like for today, is like I have a whole list on my website, developmentaldoctor.com, of mindfulness apps and things people can use. Okay. And my practices are there. But yeah, at the beginning, for sure. I mean, if you have a familiarity with it, the most important thing is setting a timer, because otherwise, you know, our mind tricks us into all the reasons why we shouldn't. That was enough for today, you know, and everything else. So either use an app with some guidance, or at least set a timer so that you can move to whatever period of time you're doing. And that ongoing practice is one thing, just not with as much regularity as you can make happen, typically does benefit from scheduling, or you end up, you know, not remembering to do it. Then there are, we often call them informal practices, which are really helpful too. You know, they're kind of like taking the stairs, which is like a healthy thing to do in day-to-day life, but not exactly the same as going to the gym, but it's certainly valuable. You know, taking the stairs instead of the elevator, I mean.
Okay.
So informal practices can just be like when you're with your child, just like make that your practice for a few minutes. Like, just, you know, I'm going to try to give full attention to these few minutes as best as I'm able. Or I'm washing the dishes and I'm going to try to just focus on washing the dishes instead of all the rumination that's going on. And just pay attention to just the feel of the water and the soap and the dishes, you know, not because it's magic, but just because it's like a little mental breather. If we allow ourselves those few minutes of doing that without worrying about, you know, college planning or whatever else. So the informal practices, you know, are endless. You just got to sort of, it's just a matter of, you know, trying to almost, you know, take moments of rest through the whole day that way, of just like pause, give full attention to this activity, just let the mind settle for a moment. Maybe get a little more intentional. You know, it's like stop long enough to make a choice about what we're doing next instead of staying caught up in routine. And that's a second way of practicing that's really valuable. And then there are some other practices, and I know you wanted to talk about this, so I might as well end with it, is there are some other practices that more develop specific traits. And one of the most studied really comes out of a program primarily from a wonderful researcher named Kristen Neff out of Austin. There's always one I wanted. This is definitely an is it true moment. So this is, I mean, my family's from the Bronx originally, and I always catch myself when I start talking about this of like, you know, really ask yourself, is this true? Is self-compassion practice. It's recognizing that, so forget the word for a second and I'll talk you through it. But, you know, self-compassion practice really comes down to the fact that as long as all this stuff has been talked about, there's centuries old writing talking about it, there's a very habitual human voice, a very habitual mental habit of just being really negative with ourselves. You know, and you can think for a moment as you're listening to me about, you know, like maybe making a embarrassing mistake in front of a bunch of people and thinking like, you know, what's the first thing my inner critic would say? You know, but then if you think about like being in the first row of an auditorium when a friend makes the same mistake on stage, you know, what would your dialogue be then? You know, for a friend, you'd immediately, the first chance you had, take them aside and say, it's fine. No one cared. Everyone makes mistakes. It'll be okay. And it turns out that that is a trait we can develop in ourselves and sort of how we, in our own inner dialogue through habit and repetition, that it doesn't mean we're all perfect and it's all good. We still got to work on stuff. But if you cultivate this idea of self-compassion, of treating ourselves the same way we would treat a friend, it improves our well-being. It changes how we treat other people, which is intuitive on some level. You know, when we're defensive and down on ourselves, we talk about the, you know, to other people differently. And actually it improves our ability to persist in the long run. People are often afraid that that inner critic is what's driving them to be better people, but it isn't driving you to be a better person any more than if you treated your friend like that, they'd be very happy with it.
Right.
So self-compassion practice is a specific practice, which you can find again on through those same links on my website.
Yeah, I'll put that all in the links of the
So the short podcast of the practice, though, just to make sense of it, is it's typically described as a practice in three parts, and it sort of fit into a breathing meditation, each of which develops self-compassion in a different way. One of which is actually partly the practice of mindfulness, because when you think about it, as a parent, just giving ourselves permission to feel whatever we're feeling is kind of self-compassion. We're often trying to pretend we're not angry with our kids, or pretend we're not overwhelmed. So mindfulness itself is kind of a self-compassion practice, because we're sort of allowing ourselves to just experience things without denial and frustration. And like, this is just what's going on. It's how I feel today. Second part of the practice, which is equally valuable, is sometimes referred to as common humanity. So it's an active reminder that, like, everybody has times like this. You know, so when wheels start coming off, most of us tend to, you know, compound hard on ourselves. Like, I'm the only one who ever does this. God, why does this always? Well, how come I always, you know, it's like that dialogue of like, I'm the worst. So the second part of the practice, again, in an unforced way, it's just meant to be a reminder. You're not trying to pretend to feel differently than you do. It's just that reminder of like, oh yeah, every parent has moments like this, or every parent of kids with ADHD, or whatever language works for you. So that's the second part of the practice, and very, very valuable. And then the third part of the practice is the most nuanced, and you almost have to just go out and try it for a while to see what's possible. But since you can't eliminate thought, right, the critic is still going to be there regardless. What you can do instead is just remind yourself what you would say to a friend. So the third part of the practice is just like literally a mental reminder of like, may I stay kind with myself, or may I stay strong, or whatever feels natural in that moment. And what happens over time is you start to depersonalize the critic a little bit, and just like catch yourself when you go down that path of criticism and go, no, you know, let me just stay kind with myself. It'll be okay. You know, this happens to everybody. And if you can practice that regularly, it becomes part of life, which fundamentally changes how you parent for most people, because most of us as parents, you know, if we're not paying attention, can be pretty intensely influenced by that critic, which also, you know, obviously undermines our own resilience and change. You know, it's like this domino effect of stuff if we don't choose to manage it.
So is mindfulness and self-compassion practice two separate things, or can you get self-compassion from being mindful?
100%. So it's a great question. Some of it's all interrelated. Sometimes it's referred to as two wings on a bird. You know, it's like if you practice mindfulness without self-compassion, it can be very much like, you know, putting your life under a microscope and, you know, feel unpleasant. And, you know, you can't practice compassion alone, because the awareness matters. So they're fully complementary. And really, if you want to sort of end what we started talking about mindfulness, mindfulness practice itself contains self-compassion for sure, because, you know, the way I sometimes see it is, if you're going to choose every day to spend a few minutes doing this practice that is inherently pretty much impossible, right? You can't possibly focus on every breath. You know, you're developing self-compassion directly in a way, because one of the most, perhaps the most important part of breathing practice is the instruction of, you're going to get distracted. And when you get distracted, without giving yourself a hard time, just start over, which is a great message for all of us in everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to put in your best intentions, and then you're going to get distracted. And that happens in life too. And can you come back and sort of reset without anything extra added? Just, yeah. Oh, I was off. So self-compassion is, you know, it's sort of just like leaning in more into the self-compassion to the full self-compassion practice. But it's inherently part of mindfulness practice also.
Yeah. Okay. Dr. Burton, as we wrap up, what would be your words of wisdom for parents who are raising ADHD kids in regards to the practice of mindfulness and self-compassion?
I think the bottom line is that to fully manage ADHD as a parent, you know, however you're going to do it, has to start with just acknowledging your own needs and taking care of yourself enough that you can do all the rest. So I hope many people listening are able to find some value in the practice of mindfulness. But if it's not that, you know, I think I overquote this probably, but, you know, I always say the best piece of advice I got starting medical school, and medical school is honestly not so unique. Like, everybody has their challenging moments. So it's sort of the best piece of advice I got starting this really challenging stretch of time in my life was find one thing that keeps you sane and just don't let go. And I think, you know, whatever it is we're navigating, you know, that's the bottom line, is like to find the stuff that's going to, you know, within the reality of your life, you're busy, keep you strong enough to do what you need to do. And that's really what it comes down to.
That's great. Thank you for joining me.